Greetings once again to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 12th of May, 2013. This would be nav briefing number 64. The title is Christ or the Symbiont. Now I'm going to dedicate the greater part of this briefing to the critical subject, the crucial subject or topic of the Christos figure, and review some of the points I made regarding Christ versus Christos in Not in His Image. And hopefully, although I hate to use that term, let's just say it's my desire right now, my burning desire rather than my hope, because all hope has been burned out of my bones. But it's my burning desire to cover this subject and clarify this subject. Difficult, naughty, twisted, corrupted subject to the best of my ability in this briefing. But before I launch into that material, I just want to take a moment here to present to you some comments on the long documentary, I guess you could call it that, that I linked in a previous crew note mailing. That is this documentary entitled, Who is Elisa Lam? This documentary on, which is also goes by the title Beings of Frequency, I believe, is the product of some young people working in Iceland. As you know, they introduced themselves at the end of the documentary. And they have used this question, Who is Elisa Lam, as the title of their website, which was just put on the internet very recently. In fact, I noticed when I came across this group of people that they had established their website on the first day of the lunation of Swandeva, and then on the first day or second day of the succeeding lunation of Chinnamasta or Mirita, they posted this long study of frequencies and the effect of shortwave frequencies upon the human mind. Now, I don't know what to make of this group of people or how they're going to proceed. I don't have any idea, but they seem to have a plan. They have a powerful initiative. And there are a number of points in the documentary that are extremely important, I would say. But also there are a few points that are troublesome. So I'd just like to briefly go over my notes here. In the first place, bear in mind that the Schumann frequency, 7.83 hertz, is not the pulse of the planet as such. If you imagine that the planet is pulsing like a sponge, as it were. Suppose the planet Earth is conceived to be a dense but porous material sponge, and suppose that the matter of the Earth is alive, which is correct, and suppose that in its entirety the matter of the Earth is pulsing like a heart, and that the frequency of the pulse beat is 7.83 hertz. This is not correct. 7.83 hertz is a figure arrived at by a mathematical process. It's a number that you get when you calculate the propagation of a wave, of a radio wave, around the circumference of the planet within the range of the livable atmosphere. So it is rather something like a pulsation of the atmosphere and a pulsation in the atmosphere. Now, you could say, arguably, that it's grounded upon the material body of the planet because the atmosphere itself is seated on the material body of the planet, isn't it? And you may know, and this is a detail of science that fascinated me since I was a teenager and I have yet to understand its implications, but you may know that the weight or pressure of the atmosphere in which you are now bathing is 16 pounds per square inch. So every square inch of surface on the planet at ground level is subject to 16 pounds of pressure from the weight of the atmosphere. So obviously the interaction between the material mass of the planetary body and the atmosphere which surrounds the mass is a potent physical reality. The atmosphere has a weight. It sits, it is seated on the Earth. And so arguably, the 7.83 frequency of vibration in the atmosphere could be communicated to the material body of the Earth, or I suppose you could say that it arises from the material body of the Earth, but I don't exactly see the Schumann frequency operating in that respect. Second point is the Schumann frequency is not absolutely constant, and variations of it have been observed over the last 20 or 30 years. In the genre of New Age spirituality, there is a great deal of speculation about these variations. For instance, Greg Braden is one individual I might cite in that respect. Now, Greg Braden is someone who baffles me because he's obviously quite intelligent and he's obviously dedicated to inspiring or uplifting the human species out of its current quandary. But Greg Braden, rather than talking about what is really and truly verifiably wonderful and mysterious about the planet, tends to invent or fabulate things that are mysterious. It's not necessary to fabulate things that are mysterious. There are plenty of genuinely mysterious things happening on this planet that are both of a mystical and a physical and geophysical nature. And those aspects of the life processes of the planetary animal mother are there for us to investigate and to enjoy. So one of the things that puzzles me about Braden's presentations is that more often than not, he invents and embellishes in such a way that it's as if I were a car salesman trying to sell you a classic 57 Chevy. Now, if I'm going to sell you a classic 57 Chevy, it was one of the most beautiful cars ever made, convertible, all I have to do is indicate to you what are the real features of this car. The upholstery, the design of the body, the engine. What are the real features? But suppose that I invented things about the 57 Chevy to make it appealing to you, then what an absurd exercise that would be, because there's no need to invent mystery, there's no need to invent science or to fabulate science. And this often happens, for instance, Greg Braden in one of his talks, again, speaks literally as if the Hertz frequency was due to the pulsation of the Earth operating like a pulsating heart. That is not correct, as far as I know. Also, he has followed others in the genre in making speculations regarding the apparent increases to be seen in the Schumann frequency for the last couple of decades, I guess. Braden notes, as other people have, that 7.83 is very close to 8. And 8, as you know, is a number in the Fibonacci series. 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13. And so he's speculating that the Schumann resonance, due to some vast conscious act of planetary awakening, would be increasing to reach exactly 8, which it apparently has already reached, and then would be increasing more and more toward 13, the next Fibonacci number, and I believe that increase was supposed to have been reached by December 21st, 2012. You see what I'm getting at? None of this is necessary. It's not necessary to build embellishments and fabulations of this kind, because the true nature of these phenomena is in itself mysteriously enough. So the discipline is to see what these phenomena are in their true nature. So much for my little exposition on the Schumann frequency. At the beginning of the documentary, the film, I'm just going to call it the long film, the Elisa Lam people refer to Luc Montagnier, who discovered AIDS. Now, be very careful about that. I don't know what work he has done on the electrolysis of DNA. I haven't researched that, but AIDS does not exist as such, and so if Luc Montagnier is known for having discovered AIDS, then his credentials in my mind would be a little bit questionable. Next we go on to melatonin and the pineal gland. And again, you know, what is the actual function of the pineal gland? I really don't know. I can't arrive at a solid or experiential concept of it, but once again, embellishment and fabulation surrounds the subject of the pineal gland. I'm certainly struck by the idea that that melatonin is an important chemical in the human body, and I'd like to find out more about that. Also, the observation that the pineal gland cannot distinguish between radio waves and light waves is certainly a fascinating one. And it reminds me of the observation that has been made regarding the human subconscious. The human subconscious cannot distinguish between a fact and a fiction. Did you know that? So if you say George Washington was the first president of the United States, the human subconscious absorbs that statement as a proposition in a story, in a narrative. By itself, that statement, George Washington was the first president of the United States, standing alone doesn't mean much of anything if you put it into the framework of the narrative of American history or the narrative of world history. It means something. So the subconscious operates on narratives. The subconscious is structured like a language, as someone famously said. And the language of the subconscious is not a passive language. It is a language that runs on an operative syntax of narrative. So that statement, George Washington is the first president of the United States, which is a fact, is received by the subconscious and absorbed into a narrative tapestry. But you could say that George Washington was a human being, was a giant white mouse who took the form of a human being. Say that to the subconscious. And guess what? It will not distinguish between that statement and the previous one. Think about that. It's only the dianoia faculty that you have of endowment, which is related to spoken language. Spoken language, what you can speak. I can speak as a human animal and say, the statement that George Washington was a huge white mouse in disguise is fiction. And the statement that he was the first president is fact. That's dianoia speaking. I can speak that aloud, but my subconscious does not make that distinction. The subconscious runs on any narrative syntax provided to it, irregardless of whether it's fictional or factual. Just thought I'd point that out to you. So, interesting that the term mitosis comes up in this presentation. We hear that every day, countless millions of cells in your body are replaced by the process of mitosis. the replacement of cells. I thought that the term beings of frequency, which they use, was very much out of the syntax of Merita. She may be called the mistress of frequencies. The shift of Merita just ended 2 days ago, you know, with a massive solar eclipse. Now, it wasn't visible in the Northern Hemisphere. It was in Australia, where it proved to be observed by many people. It was a perfect annular eclipse, A-N-N-U-L-A-R. That refers to the ring-like formation of light around the dark disk of the moon. Eclipses occur when the sun, moon, and earth are aligned at the moment of the new moon or full moon. And that can only happen when the moon itself is near the line, the orbital line, occupied by the sun and earth. And that orbital line is called the ecliptic because it is the region where eclipses occur. So that was a very powerful eclipse. I don't know how you felt about that Wednesday, Thursday of last week. But it knocked me out for about 18 hours. And that was the fantastic orchestral conclusion of Merita's shift for the year 2013. Now, the word Nazi comes up in this film, and I have to say, I do not use the word Nazi anymore, and I am extremely wary of people who use it in any way, shape, or form. The word Nazi is too corrupted to even use. I am certain that those of the Nazi Party under the direction of Adolf Hitler in the Second World War did some bad things. But I am equally certain that the bad things that the Nazis did were no worse, and in some cases far less, than the bad things that other people did during the Second World War, including the Americans under Eisenhower, and most certainly including the Russian Jewish Bolsheviks with their frontman Stalin. So this, I consider that the demonization of the term Nazi belongs to the Holocaust scenario, which is a massive psyop. And so anyone who uses the word Nazi in a facile or careless manner, in an offhanded manner, to mean sadistic, evil, tyrannical, is in fact endorsing the Holocaust scenario. So in this film, they refer to some things that the Nazis were doing. Well, whatever the Nazis were doing before and during the Second World War is Mickey Mouse Club compared to what the American government had the Nazi doctors and scientists do after the war when they were imported to the United States under Operation Paperclip. Nazi brain science? Okay, I can accept Nazi brain science. I can accept certain experiments took place by Nazi doctors. What was the scale of those experiments? What was the agenda behind those experiments? I cannot say. But the claim that Hitler intended to use mind control techniques to take over the entire planet is absolutely bogus. And this, again, is an example of the booby trapping of the historical narrative by the Holocaust scenario. And no one has done more to demonize the German people. And it's really, when it comes down to it, it's the German people. You know, Eli Weisel said, and you can find the quotation easily on the internet, that everyone in this world should hate, should have a virile hatred for the German people. He actually said that. Now, that is like one of the biggest hate-mongering statements I've ever heard, coming from a self-declared champion of the Jewish cause, whose claims to have been in a concentration camp appear to have been fraudulent, by the way. If you go and look for the evidence, it can't be found. But what a statement to make. I mean, a German person today who said anything even slighting against a Jewish person faces ruin of their whole life and years in prison. And he can stand up and make that general comprehensive statement about the German people. Not even the Nazis, the German people. This is where it goes if the mind control elements in the Holocaust scenario are not checked at the very first moment that they arise. Okay, moving on. The film talks about LSD and PCP. Don't put LSD and PCP in the same sentence. Please. It also gives an example of horrific testimony, and there's a lot of horrific testimony from the brain control drug experiments of the United States government during the 50s and 60s. There are a lot of instances that one could take. Why did they excerpt one of a woman talking about being given an intravenous shot of LSD? I would like to know what is the agenda of these kids on the use of psychoactive plants and sacred plant medicines. Do they have any knowledge that such sacred plant medicines exist? And are they able to distinguish between PCP and ayahuasca? Are they able to understand that LSD has a record for being probably the most benevolent and harmless mind-altering chemical on the planet? And the fact that it was used maliciously and in a clandestine manner by certain black ops in the United States is not a good way to represent the problem of chemically induced mind control. So this again is another flaw in this film, and I would seriously ask those who make this film to look closely at this feature. At the 33rd minute in the film, they make this statement that synthetic telepathy, now there's a term for you, uses radio waves as if they were sound waves. Is that really true? You know, what is this voice of God technology? And is it really possible to make a person hear a voice in their head using radio waves that beam directly to the brain? I mean, this is the claim. But does it actually work that way? I was talking with Quintry about this, and she said, look, that's not how you hear a voice. You hear a voice normally because of an acoustic signal that enters your inner ear, passes the eardrum, passes the drum and hammer mechanism, and that acoustic signal operating on the frequency of a sound wave, which is what, 628 miles an hour, is converted by the brain into an electrochemical signal. Okay, but what do you actually hear when someone says, your tea is ready? Do you hear the acoustic signal carried in the frequency of the sound wave, which is within a human range of perception, or do you hear the acoustic / chemical signal that's flashing in your brain? I don't know. It raises some interesting questions. But one thing is certain. This term, synthetic telepathy, has come into our discourse during the shift of Merita in 2013, and it's not going to go away. What I find interesting about the group of young people who've done this film is that they appear to be prepared to go to battle against synthetic telepathy, or mind control technology, as they call it. I prefer to call it brain control technology, because I think it's a dangerous presumption to assume that this technology actually achieves mind control. It may well achieve brain control. If someone puts an implant in your brain, like Jose Delgado did with a bull here in Spain, and then flicks a switch, causing the bull to stop charging, or flicks a switch and cause you to turn right or turn left or jump cartwheels across the lawn, that's not mind control. That's brain control. So whatever the case, I think this film represents a valiant beginning of a strategy against the psychological warfare being perpetrated on this planet. And it's certainly worth wondering if at some point the number of people enlisted into the Elisa Lam group might like to know about Channel 16, and they might like to know about Dakini telepathy and DI and the use of the moon as a communal telepathic console and things of this sort. I'm not sure what their actual aim is, but it appears to be, first of all, of course, to inform people in the world about the technology of shortwave frequency brain control. But beyond informing people, what are they planning to do? Do they have a counter strategy? Do they have a counter technology? You and I in the GNE have a counter technology, don't we? And we're in the process of using it and testing it and seeing how it works. So in that respect, we may be a few steps ahead of them. I don't want to presume that I can read their agenda because I'm not exactly clear on what it is. But keep your minds open to this group of people and watch them, check in on them once in a while and see how they're doing. And maybe at some point it would be fitting to liaison with them. That's all I would care to comment on at the moment without taking more time. There is the subject of TAMI, or Thought Amplified Mind Interface, and the subject of Medusa, which is a Navy patent that attacks the body with the tingling sensation. Interesting how the word Medusa comes up in the course of this film. But that is something to be discussed at another time. We're reaching the half-hour point in this briefing, and I'd like to move on to the main topic, which is the problematical subject of Christ. Right now, in the set of tasks that I face in my life as the navigator and in my professional life as a writer, I have as a priority the necessity to revise or correct, make small revisions and corrections in the printed text of Not in His Image. Now, I've got a copy of Not in His Image right here. And up until now, as the book has gone out, and the book continues to sell in the English version, with a number of passages, not many, but a number of passages where I describe the Aeon Christos in relation to the Aeon Sophia. And principally, as you know, there are two ways to regard that relationship within the frame of the sacred narrative. The first is to consider the Christic intercession, that is, the assistance brought to the Aeon Sophia by the Aeon Christos once she had materialized into the planetary body. So that is what we call, of course, a post-plunge event, a post-plunge after Sophia had departed from the galactic core and turned into the Earth. The Christos Aeon interceded. Now, I'm not changing that. That remains a constant and steady and consistent element in the 9-episode version of the sacred narrative. And that Christic intercession, as you know, occupies episode 8. It is the penultimate episode before episode 9, which is the one that we are currently in. So, As far as the Christos goes, that role is clear. However, the second way of referring to Sophia and Christos goes back into the Pleroma before her plunge. And that concerns the generation of the Anthropos in the Pleroma. Now, in the version of Not in His Image, which came out in November of 2006, I describe the generation of the Anthropos before Sophia's plunge as a tantric affair achieved by two aeons together, namely Sophia herself and the aeon Christos. Subsequent to the publication of the book, I find that I am compelled to revise that detail and to replace Silete for Christos in that function. And you know all about this already. In fact, sometime back, there was a discussion between a crew member, Shelley, and myself, which I posted in the crew notes, setting forth my reasons for making that revision. And I won't go over that. I won't review that because I don't think it's necessary. But I would like to sharpen the profile of Christos and to bring forward the parameters, you might say, for the inclusion of the Aeon Christos in correction. And I would do that somewhat along these lines. In the first place, let me assure you that the translations of Not in His Image into other languages include these revisions already. So when Dominique Guillet was translating Not in His Image into La Passion de la Terre, I requested those revisions. I requested the replacement of the name Thelete for Christos in certain passages. And working closely with my translator, Elena, on the Italian edition, which came out in February, I did again the same thing. And because we went through the text line by line, editing the Italian text against the English text, I was able not only to make those revisions, but to add a couple of corrective phrases, and also to add, most significantly, the entry of Thelete into the glossary. Because if you look now at the English or English language edition of Not in His Image, you'll find that Thelete, or Thelete, can be pronounced either way you like, is not included in the glossary. And that was a very serious omission. So, in future editions of the English version, once I get around to making these corrections, that will no longer be the case. I'd just like to say, by the way, that in addition to what I've already said about why I made Christos to be the consort of Sophia, I'd like to add one more comment, which has come to light in my own mind over recent months. Working with you in the GNE is giving me a great deal of confidence in how I handle the sacred narrative. I've said to you that the power of the human imagination could be compared to a fire hose that's turned on and gushing an enormous torrent of water. Now, it takes at least one or two stalwart men to hold one of those fire hoses. The fire hoses, as you know, have handles attached to them that unfold so that one man can grip those handles firmly while directing the torrent of water to a burning building. Well, imagine handing a fire hose of that size to a four-year-old child. Well, that's pretty much the situation with the power of the narrative imagination in the hands of a human animal. And the more that we investigate and explore and embrace and enjoy the beauty and power of the Sophianic narrative, the stronger becomes the imagination you use to follow that narrative. The narrative enforces the imagination that you give to it. So right now I'm operating with a lot more power of imagination than I was 5 or 6 years ago when I completed Not in His Image, thanks to you. Because you're my team, and it is your concentration that supports my concentration. I mean, just think of that beautiful clip of the Japanese woman with the feather and the spines of palm fronds. I believe that's what they are. She has at her feet 8 or 9 of those spines and a feather. And she balances it all in one construction. And I could not help but thinking as I watched that clip that the power of concentration she required to do that, which of course was due to training on her part, her training and her skill and her talent, but that power of concentration by which she achieved that act of balance was assisted and supported by the observation of the people who were watching her. I mean, I got that impression. Now, maybe that's not the case regarding that particular feat by that Japanese woman. Maybe not. But it is certainly the case regarding the GNE. Because if I were attempting to extrapolate the GNE within the framework of correction, completely by myself, and I had no one to talk to and no one to address these briefings to, I wouldn't be able to handle the levels of imaginative empowerment at which I'm now operating, which are, I must say, at the absolute height of my powers. In the mystery schools, they operated in cells, in groups of 8 and 16, precisely because it took that many people to sustain and steady the force of this narrative power, which, as I've said, is represented by the light streaming from the eye of the bull, Aldebaran. Well, I didn't have as much confidence when I wrote Not in His Image as I do now. And I also wanted to make sure that I could answer any criticism that might be leveled at me by scholars or non-scholars who claimed that I was not observing the textual evidence, okay? I rigorously, ferociously observed the textual evidence in everything that I wrote about the sacred narrative and Not in His Image. And what can I tell you about the textual evidence that you need to know? 2 things, my friends. The first thing is that Thelete, the aeon Thelete, or the name Thelete for an aeon, occurs in Gnostic, Coptic, and Greek material, but it does not occur in any coherent sentence in the syntax of the narrative. Therefore, Thelete is there. There is an allusion or suggestion of a pairing of Thelete with Sophia in the surviving material. But that's all. There is not one single thread that I can cite, not one single line or proposition that supports the claim that Thelete and Sophia paired to generate the Anthropos. However, there is an indication that Christos was in that role, and that is found in a Valentinian exposition in the Nag Hammadi Library. A Valentinian exposition, as I've said before, is a fragmentary document in very poor condition that contains evidence of an attempt of a compromise by the Alexandrian Gnostic Valentinus, who went to Rome and mingled with the early Christian ideologues. And Valentinus attempted to compromise, to appease these Christian ideologues, many of whom, like Clement of Alexandria, were Gnostic wannabes. They wanted to have the expertise and privilege of mystery school initiation, but they didn't. They wanted to put themselves at the same status as the Teleste, but they couldn't. And out of that idiot compassion, which so often characterizes the human animal, well, Valentinus went head over heels into compromising with them. This is my belief. And so even though were he to have been a true Telestes, he would have known that Christos was the intercessor, but not the co-generator. Even though he would have known that, he made the foolish decision to speak of the Christos in another fashion. And in fact, if you read a Valentinian exposition, you'll see that the spin of that cosmology coming from Valentinus was to really downplay the role of the Sophia herself. In Sethian Gnosticism, the Aeon Sophia is our savior, if there is any savior in Gnosticism. She is the soteriological power. But for Valentinus, Christ was the soteriological power, and Sophia, he represents Sophia as more or less the hapless victim of her circumstances and of her excesses. So you see, at the time that I wrote Not in His Image in 2005 and 2006, and at the time that it went to press, I decided to rely on the textual material so that I would not be criticized for false or groundless embellishment. And that is why, probably the principal reason why, due to a lack of confidence with the narrative, that I did not make it Thelete and Sophia. But now we're in a different phase of the narrative. Now, Sophia herself is in correction, and all the elements of her story are more vividly and intimately accessible to us, to human animals, than they have ever been before. So I consider it imperative that I clarify these points. Now let's look for a moment at the identity, if you will, of Christos. As I've pointed out, those translators of the Nag Hammadi materials who come from a Judeo-Christian background, most of whom are scholars of Christian religion and follow the Christian faith, had no reservations whatsoever in translating the word Christos, which is written in a coded form in the Nag Hammadi documents, into Christ, and thereby equating the CHRS with a line over it in the Gnostic texts with the historical Christ of the New Testament, the Christ of St. Paul. That equation is entirely illegitimate. That equation is wrong. Christ of St. Paul, Christ the risen Messiah, Christ the Son of God, the divine entity that lived in the human person and body of Jesus and then was crucified for the sins of the world and resurrected itself. That Christ, that Pauline Christ, is not the Aeon Christos. And the two should never be confused. But obviously the confusion is longstanding and beyond repair. So what are we going to do with the Christ? How are we going to handle the Christ, Christos meme, if you will, within the frame of correction? It's difficult even to pronounce the word Christ without being falling back into a morass of assumptions, you know. I asked my Belgian friend, Chantal, one time, you know, she's not at all religious, and she rejected her Catholic school upbringing at a very early age. But she has been imprinted and programmed with a conception of Christ. So I asked her, you know, what the word Christ meant. Christ, you know. And she told me it meant le crucifié. Well, there you say. I mean, doesn't that just say it all? Here is someone who's in the same class with millions of other people around the world who think that Christ means the crucified one. So I explained to her that the word Christ, as you say it in French, Christ, or Christ, is from a Greek root meaning to christen or to anoint. To anoint. And that has nothing to do with crucifixion. I mean, the difference between anointing and crucifixion is like the difference between a good massage with oil of Rosa Mosqueda and getting run over by a 16-wheel truck. Okay? But no. Not in the minds of those human animals who have been imprinted with the glorification of the victim-perpetrator syndrome through salvationist religion. I want to emphasize upon you, I know I'm saying many things here you already know, those in the crew and those who've read my books, and I don't mean to spin my wheels or to plow over already planted ground, but I just want to emphasize what we're up against here. And that you who've read not in his image, and you who are in the correction process in the GNE and in the Dakini connection in Planetary Tantra, are those few privileged animals on this planet who can stand against this massive behavioral programming scam. And I think that the kind of showdown between those who perpetrate psychological warfare on this planet and those who stand for sanity and love is nigh, as indicated by the Elisa Lam film. But those of you who show up for that battle need to bear in mind that whatever the mind control technologies or brain control technologies of today may be, there is behind them centuries of mental, psychological, emotional, and behavioral programming through the Zadok principle and the salvationist religions that rose from that principle. And this is what we're up against. I mean, it's massive. It's absolutely overwhelming. And the only thing that can turn the tide, the only power strong enough to correct that problem, note the word correct, is what? What is the power accessible to you, strong enough to correct and heal the centuries of psychological abuse from salvationist religion? Well, it's the power and beauty of her story. Because, in fact, the historical record shows, my friends, that if her story had not been repressed, none of that would ever have come to be. If Christianity was such a wonderful message of love and a message of the divine care of the Heavenly Father and the sacrifice of his Son, his only begotten Son. If all that were true, all that of the Christos Redeemer narrative were true, then why didn't the early Christians just let it coexist alongside the Sophianic narrative and see which one people chose? But no, there cannot be any coexistence. There is no coexistence in Judaism. Absolutely not. No, they don't even want to coexist with the rest of humanity. There's no coexistence in Christianity, as shown by his historical record of cultural and intellectual genocide in Europe and around the world. And there is certainly no coexistence in Islam. And the measure of that refusal of coexistence, as I've said before, is the measure of the power of her story. The only story, the only narrative on this planet that engages your imagination as a human animal in the heights and depths of its capacity, as mine is engaged, and as I demonstrate to you in every single one of these briefings, don't I? So what do we do now with the Christos within the correction narrative? Well, I propose that we make a commitment. You make a commitment with me, you who embrace this story, never to use the word Christ or Christos ever again. Just talk about the symbiont. In other words, let's see if we can re-imprint the human imagination and seal off the behavioral programming of salvationism, to seal it off from further propagation by changing the syntax. Now, I propose to you, changing the syntax of that specific term, I propose to you also as well a subtle practice. I propose a subtle twist, if you will. I am not stating that the Aeon Christos is the symbiont. No. I'm stating that the symbiont is the replacement of the Aeon Christos in the correction narrative as it now proceeds. Now, as far as the role of the Aeon Christos goes in episode 8, and according to the received material, that's fine. Here it is. You know, the Christic intercession, I'll read this for you. The Christic intercession cannot be found in the surviving Gnostic materials. You have to find it in the paraphrase of Irenaeus. You know that, don't you? I've put that on metahistory.org under the section of mythos in the Gaia Sophia category, book 1, chapter 4, from Against Heresies by Irenaeus. An account given by the heretics of the formation of Akamoth, origin of the visible world from her disturbances. The following are the transactions which they narrate as having occurred outside of the Pleroma. The enthymesis, or impetuous desire, of that Sophia who dwells above, which they also term Akamoth, being removed from the Pleroma, together with her passion, they relate to have, as a matter of course, become violently excited in those places of darkness and vacuity to which she had been banished, that is to say, the spiral arms of the galaxy. For she was excluded from light, the organic light or central stellar mass of the galaxy, and the Pleroma, and was without form or figure, like an untimely birth, because she had conceived nothing from her counterpart. But the Christos, Aeon, dwelling in high, took pity upon her, and having extended himself through and beyond Staros, the boundary of the galactic nucleus, he imparted a figure to her, but merely as respected substance, and not so as to convey intelligence. Having effected this, he withdrew his influence and returned, leaving Achamoth to herself in order that she, being sensible of her suffering, as being severed from the Pleroma, might be influenced by the desire of better things, while she possessed in the meantime a kind of odor of immortality left in her by Christos and the Holy Spirit. Achamoth is a corruption of the Hebrew word chokmah, which is found in the Kabbalah and in the tree of Sephirah. And it is a code name for the part of the power of the organic light of the divine Sophia, which morphed into the terrestrial elements. So it represents the fallen aspect of the organic light of Sophia, Achamoth, Sophia Achamoth. And so there you have it. That stays. Don't change that. And you can always go back and read chapter 14 on the Christic intercession and not in his image. But when you read chapter 14, it's also necessary to then go ahead and read chapter 23 on the species self connection. Because in that chapter, I point out that the Aeon Christos left an imprint in the livable atmosphere of the earth. This is a remarkable mystical fact, and you even find it loosely indicated in the text of Irenaeus, where he says that Sophia possessed a kind of odor of immortality left to her by Christos. He calls it an odor. Remember that Irenaeus was not an initiate, and that he was writing from second, third, and fourth hand accounts and putting things together in the terms of his own limited understanding. In the 23rd chapter of Not in His Image, I explain that the effect of the Christos intercession was to imbue in the Anthropos specifically the sense of its own identity as a species. Now, the same applies for the Anthropos as applies for any human person. If you are a human person who has borderline personality problems, you have multiple personality problems because the boundaries of your personality are not well defined, that they have been damaged by abuse, then you cannot establish a sane and workable relation with another human person. You have to have an identity, a stable identity as a person, to relate to other human persons. That's just a fact. And many people in our world, due to the long-term cumulative effects of the kind of psychological warfare described in that film, have personality disorders that do not permit them to have a stable and satisfactory relation to other people. But as pertains for a human person, so pertains for the Anthropos. Unless the Anthropos has a stable identity, unless we as a species have a stable sense of our own identity, then we cannot have stable and satisfying relationships to other species that are not human. The importance of the Anthropos concept, if you will, the Anthropos principle, as Gnostic scholars call it, is that it implants in the human mind and in the human imagination a self-concept for the species. And so when each human animal can refer to that self-concept for the human species, then we have something marvelous, then we have something wonderful. And this is the effect of the Christos intercession. And that is why I describe it as the species self connection. You know? And so I wrote here, against the God-self equation, Gnostics asserted the species self connection. To the ancient seers, Christos had the unique role of intermediary, an intermediary who connects us as self-conscious individuals to our species identity, and through that identity, to all other species. The mesotes is the specific term for the intermediary as an intrapsychic presence accessible to every human being all the time. Even though the intercession of the Aeon Christos for Sophia's sake occurred in remote times, it produced a permanent effect that is only evident, however, at the species level of self-conscious awareness. What does it mean for a human individual to be self-conscious at the species level? This is the kind of awareness that comes with the humility to see oneself as a member of the animal world, yet belonging to a particular species of animal. It implies that we own our humanity most deeply when we sense the sublime modesty of being a human animal, the novelty of being an animal who is human. That's how I would put it today. So there you go. And there's more there, and I explain that what has been called the etheric Christ is nothing but the imprint of the Aeon Christos in the atmosphere. And I go into intimate physical detail of what the encounter with this entity is like. And I am not the only one. Countless millions of people have encountered this imprint. I want you to be all clear on this matter of the etheric Christ, or as Don Juan called it, the mold of man. Remember, again, and I must emphasize this, reading again from that chapter, we are compelled to wonder how anything as exotic as a cluster of Bernard cells can assume human form. The everlasting Jesus, or Mesotes, does not really assume human form, but only appears to do so. In Gnostic writings, this was called docetic manifestation, from the Greek dokein, meaning to appear. The Aeon Christos does not have or has ever had human form, but in keeping with the supreme selflessness of the pleromic divinities, Christos imparts its biopsychic effect in our own image, not his. Anyone can encounter the lingering imprint of the Christic intercession as a luminous phantom in human form. It can happen at any moment, and it has happened countless times through history and before history. So there you go. That is the summary of all I would have you consider regarding the Aeon Christos in the pre-correction scenario. Now, what are we to make now of the role of the Aeon Christos in correction and in the period that ensues after the 3 years of initialization? Well, I don't have a definitive answer to that, my friends. It's like standing in front of a portal, being a sailor, I always want to say porthole. No, standing in front of a portal at the threshold. You're in a portal. And in front of you are various paths. There are various pathways of visionary ramification of the Aeon Christos in correction. But we would do well not to apply the term Christos to those ramifications. Rather, to call them the symbiont. Therefore, the symbiont might be envisioned like a delta of the Nile, Suppose that you're floating above the delta of the Nile or some great river, and you look down, the delta of the Mississippi. You see the winding serpentine body of the river. That is like the power of the Aeon Christos coming from the Pleroma in the past. So to continue with this analogy, at the juncture point where that mighty torrent of the Christos power reaches the base of the delta, stands the psychic imprint, the biopsychic imprint of the Aeon Christos in the atmosphere. That remains. That does not change, or it may change in ways that come to be known in the future. But let's just consider that to be a kind of nodal point, a holding point, a mysterious attractor. And from that point, the force of the Aeon Christos spreads and blossoms like a delta into various streams. The symbiont is multiple, my friends. The symbiont is a multi-current channel of direct aeonic interface into the atmosphere of the Earth. You don't have to consider that the Aeon Christos has come again, the second coming of the Christ. You don't have to consider that syntax, although it will, of course, cross your mind, as it has crossed my mind. But you see, if those of us in the GNE who are working the sacred narrative and living it and enjoying it like crazy start talking about the second coming of the Aeon Christos, you know where that's going to get you. Rather, picture this fanning of a single and singular torrent of aeonic force which once fed into the earth from the Pleroma. Picture it now as fanning into a beautiful fern-like pattern of vibratory channels running like tendrils through the atmosphere. This is the embrace of the symbiont. The symbiont embraces Sophia, not as a lover, but as one that she imagined to be her lover. That is the fable of Eros and Psyche, the subject of the next briefing. So what this experiment requires now, for your pleasure and edification, is simply to observe, again, to observe the effects or symptoms or signs of this multiple, multi-channeled permeation into the atmosphere. What are some of the signs that you are in the presence of the symbiont, that you are witnessing the symbiont? So far, I've detected a number of signs. One is, as I mentioned, there is a slight spontaneous psychedelic effect. It just comes absolutely out of nowhere. Suddenly, there's a chemical shift, and you feel as if you're in a mild psychedelic state, having taken a mild dose of LSD. If you can imagine what that's like, or if you've taken LSD, you'll know what it's like. There's enhancement of the perception of the physical light of the atmosphere. That is to say, not her organic light, which is a substantial and material light fleshing from the body of the planet. No, an enhancement of the atmospheric light. An ability to see in more granular detail into nature. An enhancement at the micro cosmic level. Your perception, your ability to look at a leaf, to look at running water, to look at things that are immediately present to you in the natural world is suddenly enhanced. It's as if there's an invisible hand that's turning up the volume. The amplification of sensory perception is a sign that you are in the presence of the symbiont. Well, you're always in the presence of the symbiont, but a sign that you're detecting the presence of the symbiont would be a better way to put it. Another giveaway is the feeling of love and adoration for animals. Whatever love you may now feel for animals in your life, be they dogs, horses, cats, you might find it increasing. You might find that that sense of kinship with all non-human species now becomes remarkably and unmistakably intense. You know, in the past, we've heard that the Egyptians worshipped cats under the figure of the cat goddess Bast. Well, the Egyptians were not alone. You know, the Egyptians were Africans, don't ever forget that, and they were at first black Africans, although they melded with some other people who came from elsewhere. Won't go into that, but the African peoples and many indigenous peoples around the world practiced totemism. Totemism was one of the early subjects defined in cultural anthropology and ethnology from the time of Tylor, who defined animism at the end of the 19th century. Totemism, animism. And what is totemism? It's nothing but the worship of non-human species. So certain Indian tribes of the American Northwest who held the salmon as their totem animal, or the raven, or the wolf, actually worshipped that animal. What does that mean? The worship is not like the crude concept of worship when people go into church and sing hymns and worship the absent Father God, pour out their praise and adoration for a non-existent entity or for some fiendish imposter. That's a horrific example of worship. Worship is basically adoration and the feeling of adoring these animals to the point of worship is a symptom of the symbiont. I've been feeling this a lot lately with my cat characters. And of course, they're really close to me and they support me and aid me in a lot of things that I do. And I've found that over the past month or month and a half, become even more intimate and even more intense in my feeling of connection with that other species. So there's a longing and a craving to be in the presence of these other species, the birds, the insects, a dragonfly. A dragonfly circles around the terrace. And there's a feeling of complete awe in front of this creature, to be in the presence and to be in contact with this creature. Remember that in the traditional sense of the past, pre-correction, Deon Christos secured the species self-connection. And through the species self-connection, you and I and each human animal can find the right connection to the non-human inhabitants of this planet. I don't think I need to elaborate further on that. I'll just conclude by saying that the word symbiont means that which supports, and enhances the living together of all life forms on Earth. That which supports and enhances symbiosis is the symbiont. And that is not merely the substitution in correction for the presence of the Aeon Christos, but it is the extension and amplification of that presence going forward in time. And that is the way I propose to settle the delicate matter of Christ or the symbiont.